better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out there.
Come over here, kid. Wait, sir. You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. And you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? Have a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. By country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. How are you doing this evening? I have great guests in the studio. And let's just introduce them right away. It is Kay and Don Baumhefner. You've both been here before.
Don has.
Don has. Okay. But you have, gosh.
Mm. We've talked about it.
We've just talked about it so much. Yeah. Okay. Well, Don, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
Kay, welcome.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks.
You look wonderful, as always. Your beautiful red hair. And are those amethyst earrings?
They're garnets.
Garnets. Oh, okay. It's the way to light with garnets. That's even better. Just to place the two of you really quickly in the Sonoma County landscape, you were, I believe, weren't you the inaugural chef for Opera House Cafe?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes.
A long time ago.
And that was
80s.
Really one of the very first restaurants of this. Well, there was John Ash and Company in Santa Rosa. Mm-hmm. There was Opera House Cafe, and that sort of really launched, to me, this era. And then you were also the chef for Della Fattoria.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have come home to cooking, a sweet little cooking school.
Yes, I do.
And Don, you were involved in John Ash and Company at Montgomery Village, right?
Right. Started it with John in 1980. And at that same time, Kay was working in the back with Lisa Hemingway doing the desserts.
Oh, you were? Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah, Lisa was doing the desserts there. And it was certainly the first place in Sonoma County that had a wine shop connected to the restaurant. And that was the big buzz.
Right. It was a lot of fun. And we also poured 12 different wines by the glass. And that
was
rather new in 1980. So it was a lot of fun. Uh-huh.
I loved that restaurant. Absolutely loved it.
It was a lot of fun. I ran across a picture a couple of weeks ago, and it had a picture of the by-the-glass list, and, you know, that went from $175 to $295 a glass. It's the good old days.
No kidding. Amazing. So real quick, what are you doing now?
Several things. I'm being a consulting winemaker, making the wines at Ridgeway Vineyards in Petaluma, another Petaluma Gap grower. And I have purchased all the Pinot Noir and Chardonnay from the Copeland Creek owners, and I'm marketing the Pinot Noir and the Chardonnay directly. And I'm also going to launch later this summer my first release of my Russian River Valley sparkling wine called Entourage.
And you brought a bottle.
I did.
And it says vintage 1992.
That's
Talk
right.
to me.
Well, it's been, we bottled it in early 93, and it was grown on Bob Hopkins Ranch on the Russian River, just a stone's throw from Rocchioli across the river. Mm-hmm. And it's made from 100% Pinot Meunier grapes, which has always been and still is the most widely planted grape in Champagne. but it's very narrowly planted in California. Anyway, so Bob and I made this sparkling wine then and laid it down to age on terrage in the cellar, and it's been there ever since, and it's still on the yeast and staying fresh and vibrant. And we're going to disgorge one right now, so it'll be recently disgorged and for us to enjoy.
Well, I know it's you usually have a glass of champagne every day at 6 o'clock.
Yes,
and
I do.
Here it is after 7. We better...
It was kind of tough to make it all the way. Excellent. I have some glasses here, too.
So this seems sort of like maybe a little secret project that's been going on?
Yeah, it was just been very much in the background while it was aging. And so it's gotten quite an interesting character over time, because as it ages on the yeast, it becomes softer and the bubbles get smaller and smaller every year, and the flavor gets toastier and creamier and yeastier, and going to disgorge it this summer and throw it out for the world to enjoy.
Excellent.
Oh, he has a champagne glass that he's going to put it in.
He
wants to make sure you can have the benefit of those tiny bubbles.
Yes. While he's pouring, let's talk about Come Home to Cooking. And I just have to say, it seems like such a perfect match, you having this home cooking school.
Yeah, it's really
Dawn
great.
Dawn having these wonderful wines. Look at that.
Yeah. Long been the wine and food team, and now we're getting to do it even more so, I think. And Don's really supportive of the school, being there to give expert wine advice and help people with things when we're talking about different wines you might use with something. It's been really great, besides washing a lot of dishes.
He does that too. Always a good thing.
Always a good thing, yeah.
So, and this is a cooking school that is actually in your home kitchen. You didn't build an addition and do it.
I have what could be called a professional home kitchen. Uh-huh. I designed it with the classes in mind. So that it would be a way we could all work around a central work table and work together and see each other and do all that, but where there would be enough space for people not to feel cramped. So I love the immediacy of that format and the fact that it's in a less institutional scene, so it helps people see how they might do it at home, too.
Absolutely.
I think makes it personalized in that way.
How many people can you have at one time? Oh, here, wait. Answer that question in a second.
We have to look each other in the eye, you know.
That's right. Have to look each other in the eye.
Sante. The thing I love about this is, if you don't mind my saying this, dear, the finesse of the fine bubbles and that aged wine, you know, that lovely elegant thing that happens, coupled with the fact that it's still so fresh and lively because it was just disgorged. So it's the best of both worlds. And also for people who are sulfur sensitive, you know, it's really important to drink old wine. So you have
Absolutely.
To only have the best.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Anyhow.
It's just, it's lovely.
Yeah, I like it because it is, as Kay says, soft and elegant, and it has just gotten elements in its flavor that you just only can get with 15 years sitting on the yeast. And most people don't do that, most sparkling wine producers and, and champagne, just because it costs so much to warehouse it. But every year it got better, and I just couldn't stop its development. But now I think it's ready to go, and so we're going to disgorge it and release it later this year.
Well, for its age, it has the refreshing quality and those like really light, bright, like yellow, golden, high notes. Sort of, I think, pip and apple and lemon zest, if you want to be geeky about it.
No,
it's sort of up
so.
On the roof of your on the roof of your palate rather than actually on your soft palate. It's just really...
It's very refreshing.
Yeah, very very refreshing.
Right. And I like it for that, and then I like the finish when I get that soft, toasty creaminess that sort of is a more of a textural element than an actual... thing that sticks out.
There's actually, though, right during that finish, there's a little bit of suggestion, I'll say, of toasted pine nuts right on the front.
Oh, absolutely.
During the finish, and I just love that.
I'm really glad you pointed that out, because I hadn't. How many times have I had this? And I adore pine nuts.
Yeah, that's
now you've made this extra connection for me.
Yeah, I think that. I think that's that's lovely. So, how many people can fit in the school at one time?
I try to keep it to a maximum of 12. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite number is 8, really. Uh-huh. Because it's very interactive, they're intense classes in the sense that I always have tons of things I want to cover, but I tend to do more focused topics because the point of the school is to help people really learn how to cook, not to be a slave
to
a particular... Not to entertain. Yeah. And not
I mean,
to
not to, for them, not for the students to be entertained by you,
exactly.
But to actually...
to learn. Mm-hmm. And for it not to be about being a slave to a specific recipe... Like, here is this recipe, and now you can take that home and maybe or maybe not make that for a dinner party sometime.
Right.
More my focus, which could be a lot of fun, but more what really interests me and makes me feel very passionate about doing it is seeing people come alive around what I'd call synthesized master recipes. So before the class, I do a lot of internal preparation, thinking about, okay, over 30 years of professional cooking experience, what have I learned about this? Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? And why do I do it the way I do it? And so what am I going to pull out of that? And then I write up what I would think of as a master recipe or master guidelines. And then at the bottom of that, I do all the variations. So we go through what's the backbone of this? Mm-hmm. What are the concepts? And now how are we going to mix it up? And so I like to pull them through that. So my goal is that people feel empowered in their everyday cooking, in their special occasion cooking, that it becomes more fun and more accessible for them.
Yeah.
So,
and I think that approach is so important. It's so great that you're doing it.
I love it.
I've taught some. I've mixed feelings about teaching, and I continue to do it.
Yeah.
But people, the passive, where on one hand you know people are coming partly because they want to be entertained.
Sure.
But they think that the only way that they can duplicate what you're doing is to be able to tell, is that an eighth of an inch?
Exactly.
A teaspoon, or is that like... Yeah. It's like, no. I just want you to get the spirit.
Exactly.
And I always list, or half the time in my Press Democrat recipes, I list, 15 variations. It's like, you don't have to do
great.
It like I say. Here are some other possibilities.
I am always saying that. There's no one right way to do this. Yeah. There are different ways. There's ways that work for you. There's ways that work for me. And I also tell people to trust their instincts. If this tastes flat to you, then it tastes flat to you.
Yeah.
Then what do you... So now let's talk about how would you fix that? What are the ways we would go about dealing with that? And for me, that's the mystery and magic of cooking. It's endless, and that's what makes it so fascinating. So.
How are the classes structured? I mean, let's just go...
How do we go through
when
it?
Are they... when are they offer...
Typically, I offer them on Wednesday and Saturday afternoons from 1 to 4, and I do the... So I have a class week, so it's the same class.
That's such a good idea.
So that people can opt to take it on Wednesday or Saturday. This summer for the Saturday class, because I had so many people in the spring wanting to do groups, like a private party group event, it's so-and-so's birthday, whatever, that I thought it was fun to make Saturday be a day for group reservation to sort of isolate that day so you wouldn't have a couple of independently enrolled students, tagging on to a larger group. So there are two choices like that, and... The classes run year-round, and I do a variety of topics from savory through sweets through, it's very wide-ranged. Mm-hmm. I do some menu classes, but I don't typically do menu classes.
You do more like tarts.
Or I did a three-week series on soups and stocks and, really analyzing that and what that would look like. Or I might take a category... of food beyond something as broad as soups, and I typically do each season salads, composed salads or fresh salads or balancing vinaigrettes or what are the elements of that, world favorite sandwiches or all-time favorite sandwiches, I think I called it. In the summer, of course, focus produce. Because that's what's happening.
And you do some classes where you take people to farmers markets.
I've done a couple of those this summer. I kicked off the season. I have this once a month celebration class I call "Come Home to Paradise," because Don and I have this habit of waking up in the morning and saying, "Oh, another day in paradise." Because we do. We live in the most phenomenally rich area, and we feel so grateful for that. So. I like, particularly since travel has become more and more difficult for people for all kinds of reasons, if we, what I like to say, I guess, is if we put on our travel eyes and we look around, like if we looked around here the way we would look if we were other places on holiday, what if we create in our homes what we seek out when we go on holiday? So what might that look like? What makes you really feel like you've had a day off or on vacation? Can you create a little part of that in your home or your life or with your friends or your family or whatever that looks like? So I like the celebration classes to reflect that. So Saturday, July 12th, for example, we did a Grand Iole class. And
oh,
we
nice.
Made it. We played petanque and we did, you know, we grilled fish and we did all these different things and we set up all the tables and we talked about all the different ways of making aioli and the history of the event and made it more, it's a little more party-like and it's also a way for people to bring a special friend or mate or somebody they want to share the class with. And maybe that person isn't quite as enrolled in learning about cooking as the primary student was. But it's the shared experience concept, and that's after all the point, you know. So it gives them an opportunity to do that. And then I would say in my other classes, every week, I like to let people know that I have a really wide range of students in terms of ability and experience, from complete wide-eyed beginners to actually professional chefs have taken classes from me as well as, say, the body of students are sort of serious home cooks, or cooks who become really bored with what they're doing and want to feel, you know, re-enlivened and re-inspired and, you know, feel more interested in doing what they need to do every day.
That's one of the things that a lot of people have given us wonderful feedback about the classes. And Kay wouldn't mention this, but I see the emails coming in, and we actually get letters from students. And the main word that they use when they talk about their experience in the class is inspired, that it inspires them to do more, to get back to cooking the way they used to cook.
Oh, really? The way they used to cook. Interesting. Do you have a sense, or do they say, what has intervened? What got in the way?
Life and work and a style, how we've had this whole style shift in the way we market, in the way we cook, in the way we eat, and the whole notion of the dinner table being completely disrupted. And sometimes people say, oh, well, I live alone and I don't like to eat by myself. And I say, well, how about if you eat with yourself? You know, you can have a really lovely meal with yourself. And you can have it, just make sure if it's either with yourself or with someone else or with, make it be a connection moment for you. And as Don mentioned, it's so adorable to me that people send little notes and emails about what they did. I left class and I went right to the market and I did this and I did that and I stayed up till 2 a.m. making this. And one of my very regular students, one of the nicest things I've heard is she said, now dinner at our house every night is like having a party, and everyone's eating so many more vegetables, and we're having fun with it, and it's easier, and I'm saving money. And I thought, well, make my life.
Yeah, that is really great.
That was such a gift back to me, I mean, to hear that. Yeah. So that was really fun.
Like the article in the Press Democrat today talking about how more people are cooking at home and because of the economic pinch and saving 40% over their food bill over the previous
at
month.
At least,
Yeah, I did a series actually this late spring called Stocking Your Pantry, and it was to do a master shopping list to figure how you keep things at home, how you approach your shopping, and that's what motivated me to do the farmers market classes, which you were asking me about a moment ago, that we went there, and if you start here with what's fresh and what's local and let that dictate, I mean, do you really think our grandparents went out to their garden in January and said, but my recipe says zucchini, you know. More like, okay,
really
I have kale. What am I going to do?
Yeah, you that's know? A really great, that's the perfect way to explain it.
Turn it around.
Yeah. So we're talking with Kay and Don Baumhafner here on Mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
Mouthful. It's Michelle. It is KRCB. I am here with a perfect couple. During that song, we were talking about how long they've been together. It's just one of those wonderful stories from eighth grade, and then best friends. And you know, I thank you for telling me that story. Mm-hmm. I love it. Are you getting a sense of your students? You must be local, far away, a mix.
Mostly local, but I do have people coming from distances. I've had mm-hmm. people come up from the Bay Area. I also have people who've been brought as guests of somebody else who live out of state, and now they're planning their visits around classes they want to take, which is really exciting. So they're flying in from different states, even which is just really thrilling, mm-hmm. you know, that they're coming back to have the experience, whether it's the East Coast or we've had some people from Seattle. And but I would say one thing I love is that it seems like most weeks the students are a combination of what I'd call hardcore regulars, people who take practically every one of the classes they can possibly manage, the sporadic regulars who pick and choose, but they're consistently at class, you mm-hmm. know, and then brand new people. And that's my perfect world class, mm-hmm. you know, because you have that mix of freshness and people who, because the classes are designed to be taken independently, but they all, of course, cross-reference. Mm-hmm. So for students who are taking a lot of them, they're actually learning more than just adding up those few parts. They're mm-hmm. getting 1 + 1 = 3 sort mm-hmm. of thing. And then you have the people who really want to learn about one thing, a specific thing, and they're taking that class for that point or purpose. So that's, I love that mix. And one thing I wanted to say about the farmer's market class, I started the Come Home to Paradise class with the farmer's market because of this paradise reference that I mentioned. Also so that we could talk with the growers and the vendors about what it takes for them to bring all that to the market. Mm-hmm. That it's not that they get up in the morning and their truck is magically loaded and there's hot coffee in their tray, you know. That they've probably been up all night. That they all the things they go through, and anyone who's grown a serious garden can only go to the farmer's market with the most enormous sense of gratitude, you know, because yeah. it's these people are not doing it to make a fast or a big buck. So they were, I really wanted to take students there and have them meet and talk more deeply with the farmers and the vendors mm-hmm. to learn more about what that life represents, because what that does is then when we buy that produce, for example, we see it as the precious thing it is. Mm-hmm. So when you take it home, excuse me, that opens up the conversation for not only how are you going to select what you're going to buy, but what are you going to do with this when you get it home? Mm-hmm. How will you best take care of it? How will you use it? How will you make the most of it? And when you're seeing it as something precious as opposed to something just in a plastic bag and you're, you know, stuffed behind a bunch of other stuff in the refrigerator, then maybe that suggests that you'd like to have a still life on your counter with it to show it off and love the smell it makes in your room. Mm-hmm. Maybe you look forward to opening the refrigerator to see what you have there. Maybe instead of having things in anonymous plastic containers, you have them in pretty old bowls so you get to see what it is. Maybe all of that suddenly makes you feel much more connected with your food mm-hmm. and you don't waste it.
You don't waste it, yeah.
So you continue to buy the best, but you find that you're happier, you're eating better, and you're spending less money. And that's what I would call a win-win mm-hmm. situation. So the other thing is in Europe, when people go to the market, it's a social event. It's not the way we go to the supermarket, but you go, you see neighbors, you talk,
you chat.
Yeah. They go, oh, I saved this. I know you love this. Mm-hmm. You start having this personal relationship.
Absolutely.
And then typically their markets are in a place which has various cafes or bars around it, and people go to eat and drink and play games and listen to music and all of those great fun things. So what we elected to do when we went to the markets is to have a picnic assembled from what we could buy at the market. And so after we did all this intense shopping and talking with all the vendors and growers, then we sat down and shared a meal together with things we had culled from the market. Mm-hmm. And it was so much fun. We really had a great time doing that. So yeah.
In which market?
I started with the Marin Market because the Petaluma Market wasn't quite in gear yet. And I did that in May, and then in June I did the Wednesday night Petaluma Farmers Market, and that was a lot of fun. I actually took a booth space at that market, so we brought in a picnic table and had a canopy and
how perfect.
The whole nine yards, and we sat there and had our meal, and people came in and out like, "What are you doing?" Like, "Well, we're having a cooking class," and we weren't actually cooking, but we were talking how you shop and all of that is a big part of cooking, of course. So. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a blast.
And now, actually, what we're doing, which is a fun thing to mention, this marvelous young man, Tyler Young, he and his wife, Kelly, are new to Petaluma, new to living there. They lived in the city. And just out of the goodness of his heart, he's doing this thing called Project Here. And it's about how great it is to live in our community. And when you go to events that he's helping to launch, you know, he has this little, your name tag says, "I am here," and then you put your name. I just love that. And he's just really trying to make people more aware of all the great things we have in our community. So in conversations with him, it's evolved into now what we have at the Wednesday Night Farmers Market is a piece of grass, basically of AstroTurf, I guess it is, and we have, he's doing posters of various people in Petaluma, and the idea is, and it kind of came out of my doing the cooking class there, and I was telling him how in Europe when people go to these village fêtes, you know, they bring their own plate and their utensils and their glass. So, and we do that. We go to market with that, and we purposely, you know, buy food and sit down and eat it there because we want people to see how much fun that can be. So now we have this AstroTurf there with the sign, and Wednesday night we were there, and, you know, it was standing room only. I have to say, I looked over at Tyler and gave him the old thumbs up. And I went, people are going to have to start making reservations for that little spot on this green grass here. So it's, and people were sitting down going, this is really fun. Well, of course it's fun. They're eating and talking with people they're just meeting or already have known for many years and have missed seeing because everyone's so busy running around. You know?
In a way, part of what you're saying is you're helping to give a renaissance or a rebirth to the commons.
Yes, absolutely.
The commons has been increasingly missing in this country, and anything that helps revive it, I'm all for it and support it. I think it's wonderful, and I think we really need that. I mean, I think it's, you can find many ills of society, I think, trace back to that lack of a commons.
I really agree, and I feel there's so much. Well, there's too much fear and loneliness in the world right now, and everything around us tries to convince us to be afraid or to feel that we're a failure or all these negative things. And there's so many fabulous things always going on all around us. And I really think the more we focus on that, the more those things will happen anyhow. We'll inspire that. We'll see it. It will create that positive ripple. And one of the reasons I spent a lot of time thinking of a name for the school, but before there were all the articles in the newspaper about, you know, how hard it is to buy food and feed your family and all of that, I was just thinking about all the pivotal things, the memories that happen for us that really stick and empower and support our lives are ones, well, they often involve food, but they're usually the simplest things. They might be the light coming through the leaves. They might be a particular conversation you had with somebody, a walk you took somewhere, the fragrance from a bowl of soup. You know, cooking and eating together is one of those really ancient things that grounds people profoundly. And what I feel is that we live in a time of amazing privilege and distraction, and so we keep going out there because it's all very flirty and fascinating, but we keep, it's kind of like volume buying or volume eating. You know, you keep taking another bite hoping the essence will be there, and it never shows up.
And it never is,
So if what I'm really thinking is, in the name, in a sense, cook and eat with friends, but it's about come home to yourself. You know, like, it's the answers are not going to be all out there. It's going to be in something more profound, and sort of, and usually those things are really quite simple. So that's what the name's all about, and so it is. It's a little bit of a soapbox, I must say.
Yeah. And it's a very good soapbox, and I completely support you. I want to bring you in some more, Don. Let's talk about Pinot Noir.
Oh, Pinot Noir. I remember Pinot Noir.
And, you know, that was, I didn't exactly come late to wine, but in a way I did, especially since in the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of, I think, doctors were playing my cabs bigger than your cab.
Yeah, and you still are.
Yeah, and that was just a lot of, and I wasn't involved with food and wine at that point at all, but there were a lot of headaches in a bottle.
And there still are. I mean, there's a lot of headaches in the bottle, A, because Cabernet is so much more tannic and mm-hmm. needs more aging, and people don't age it. They just drink it young, so they don't really appreciate what it could be if they aged it for 10 years. And then the Cabernet winemakers are making it so that it can be drunk in 3 years instead of 13 years, and so it's not as good as it really could be.
Yeah.
And then along comes Pinot Noir that while it can age for even California Pinot Noirs up to 30 years, they are really wonderful even at age of 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
And now, I met you, I believe. The first time I remember meeting you was at a tasting of older Pinot Noirs at John Ash and Company at its current location in, I believe, 1990.
That was a redo of our first Pinot Noir tasting that incorporated all the best Pinot Noirs made in California from the 1975 vintage.
Right,
and we
yes.
did it in September of 1980, shortly after we opened at John Ash in Montgomery Village. And I still had all those wines in my cellar 10, 15 years later, and so we tried them again. Actually, we did it on our 20th anniversary in the year 2000 also.
Oh,
and,
really?
And all the wines were still very solid, and the order changed a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but all those wines were still wonderful. And
yeah, I remember Joseph Swan.
Especially, that was my favorite.
Davis Bynum?
No, there was David Bruce.
Oh, and, David Bruce, okay.
Yeah, and there was a Chalon and Mount Eden, and those were the stars of the uh-huh. tasting that we had. And the Swans are still wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Kay and I shared a bottle of the 1979, which is the birth year of our son, earlier this year, and it's still absolutely fantastic, fresh, young, fruity, and vibrant and balanced. And if you make Pinot Noir in a style that will age, that means it's under 14 alcohol and has good acidity and is not picked to be a 16% alcohol mm-hmm. monster that will die in 5 years, but really get high ratings from people that mm-hmm. don't know what Pinot Noir really should taste like.
Yeah. What's the process? That you bring up a really good point that I think a lot of people don't understand. What's the process by which those higher alcohol wines take a dive after a few years?
It's the reason that people are doing that, first of all, is that they want to get high ratings
right.
from the expectorator and from certain scribes. And if you're tasting 50 wines at a time, the only wines that stand out are the ones that scream at you and hit you over the head. And A, that's going to be high alcohol, and B, it's going to be lots of jammy, jammy fruit. And when you get the high alcohol, as grapes ripen, they start out, it's all acid and no sugar. And at every day of ripening, you get less acid and more sugar. And the idea is to pick them at the balance point where the acid and sugars are in balance in the grapes. And that'll make a balanced wine. But in California, it's so hot. And the winemakers talk about picking at biological maturity, which is basically just an excuse to make overripe wine so that they can get higher ratings. So you get more sugar and less acid. And the acid is the backbone of the structure of the wine. And if the acid is too low, it's not going to age. Mm-hmm. So in Europe, the problem is getting enough sunshine, mm-hmm. or it used to be sunshine
yeah.
to get the grapes to ripen. So they always aged very well and required aging to become a balanced wine after mm-hmm. 10 or 20 years. Whereas in California, we have the opposite problem, of course. Mm-hmm. It's just not enough acid, too much sugar. The wines taste great for a year or two and just fall flat on their face.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Copland Creek.
Copeland Creek is one of the really nice Pinot Noir properties in the Petaluma Gap area, which is a fantastic place to grow Pinot Noir because on a day like today, we had about an hour of sunshine in Petaluma from 12:25 to 1:25. And that happens all summer long,
of
course.
I think that's kind of enough.
Yeah.
from my point of view, it's perfect.
Just right. And from Kay's point
of
view,
if I was
also
a grape, I would be a Pinot Noir. Okay, and right. So would you.
Yeah. But it works. The area works for Pinot Noir because the grapes ripen more slowly than they do in a hotter area. Even the Russian River, you know, like I talked to Rod at Swans, and, you know, they're harvesting on, say, September 12th. I'll know that 2 weeks from then is when we'll harvest in Petaluma, and that extra 2 weeks gives us that just much more time to get flavor and maturity into the grapes. Not more sugar, because it's cool enough to keep the sugar down and keep the grapes in balance, but there's enough flavor to make a wonderful wine, and so that's why the Petaluma Gap area is just a really wonderful place to grow Pinot Noir.
Then you make the wine. Now, is it you make the wine for Copeland Creek? I've always not
quite
understood.
And things have changed recently because the original owner of Copeland Creek died last year, and it's now in a transitional stage. And I'm actually not making the wines anymore there.
Oh.
And they're going to go back to using another label. So I don't think the Copeland Creek label will be on the market anymore unless someone decides to revive it, which might be a possibility.
Oh. So, well, I loved those. I loved those Pinots from you. I just loved them. You don't happen to have one, do you?
Well, let me see what I have in my box here.
Well, maybe we'll take a musical break. We may surprise you when we come back.
To gang with me this very night, we'll cuddle till the morning light by all the lave unseen, no. And ye will be my dearie, my ain dearest dearie. If she will be my dearie, can ye meet me at e'en, no? I can afford my mammy gay, she locks the door and keeps the key, and in the morning charges me, and I have put the man, oh. For she says there are deceivers, deceivers, deceivers. She says there are deceivers, ye canna trust ye, no. Oh, never mind your mammy, she'll nae doot. She met your dad herself, and should she fight, ye can't her tell. She's oftentimes done the same, oh. So lassie, gives your hand.
It's Mouthful. It's Kay and Don Baumhefner. You guys are just so wonderful. I love being in a room with you, especially when you have Pinot in your hand. Your points on what year?
This is the 2005, which is really the last Copeland Creek Pinot Noir.
Okay. Now, you have Copeland Creek. Tell me what the deal is with Copeland Creek Pinot and Chardonnay.
When the new owners decided to change the name, they just sort of stopped making the Copeland Creek Pinot Noirs. And so what I did was I purchased all the wines that I made, the Pinot Noirs and the Chardonnays, from them, and now I'm selling them directly to the public.
And under the Copeland Creek?
Correct.
Okay. And how many? Was that one vintage? Was it several vintages?
Several vintages, yeah.
What do you have?
I've finished selling the 2004 Pinot Noir, and I sold all the 2005 Chardonnay.
Yeah, okay.
So now I'm selling the 2005 Pinot Noir and the 2004 Chardonnay.
And is 2005 the last year?
Yes.
Okay. How many cases do you have?
About 800.
Okay, so I'm not going to write about this. I'm not going to send people to you. And they're still growing. I mean, you planted
involved. I planted the vineyard. We chose the site and planted it in 97. And that's what became all of the Copeland Creek wines. Mm-hmm. We planted one vineyard in 92, and then the Pinot Noir we planted in 97, with the first vintage coming to 2000 or 2001, really.
And do you think you'll get any more of the fruit?
It's a possibility, yes. But there are lots of other really wonderful growers in the Petaluma Ooh. Gap area.
Ooh, I just took my first sip. Oh, yeah. This is the sort of wine every now and then, not as often as I would like these days for reasons you've already talked about, but every now and then there's a Pinot Noir. It makes you just want to get down on your knees. And this is absolutely wonderful. What? It has that Pinot thing. There's no word for it. It's just the Pinot thing. And it's both, well, it's on every level. It's in the nose, it's on the palate, but it's also on the, it's on the palate as taste, but also as texture. And this has it on all three levels. Mm. Bless you.
Thank you very much. No, I really do enjoy drinking this wine, as does Kay. But
it goes with everything.
Yes, absolutely.
Whatever you're having for dinner,
it has that.
This works with it. It's
it has
amazing.
That ephemeral, yet at the same time, very sexy beauty to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very soft, you know, it's an elegant grape if it's made
if
the
it's
right way.
Yes.
And the problem is that if the alcohol gets above 14, if it's allowed to get too ripe, all those ephemeral qualities that you're tasting leave.
They're gone.
And it tastes more like Syrah than Pinot Noir.
Absolutely.
You know, which is not bad, but it's just
but
not
it's
as
not
good
Pinot.
As it, it's not Pinot. It's not it's as not good Pinot. As it really, really could be.
Plus, this is a darker fruit Pinot. It's not like the strawberry flavor Pinot of years before.
Right. Know? It's very complex. It's got lots of nice dark cherry qualities to it.
Wonderful.
And things, but it still has that unique ephemeral Pinot Noir quality, which in the olden days we used to call feminine. Now we call it sexy.
I call it feminine. I have no problem calling it.
Me neither.
No problem whatsoever calling it feminine. This is, in all seriousness, this is one of the best, this is the best Pinot I have tasted in a long, long time.
Thank you very
This is
much.
One of those Pinots that should say, yes, this is a reason for living. This is enough.
Yes, please.
This is enough. You know, I'll deal with everything else if I can have this.
Great. Thank you very
What's
much.
What's it sell for?
27.
Wow.
Retail. So, not bad.
Yeah.
Don't tell. Oh, yeah. Just don't tell.
All kinds of people keep telling him, you should be selling this for $50 a bottle. And he says, I want people to drink it, you know. So,
it's nice. It's really, really lovely.
Thanks. I can't afford to spend more than this for a bottle of wine. So
yourself, so you're just projecting to other people's
That's
budgets.
Right.
I've certainly had Pinot Noirs twice this price. Yeah. Sent to me as samples. I don't buy them. Yeah. That are, they're like Syrahs. Some are like Zins. I haven't tasted one that had the thing in a very, very long time. I've tasted some that it's like, okay, this is good. This is good. This is fine. But not that has the thing. So.
It's amazing. Someone not that long ago said to me, oh, well, Don's Pinot is my benchmark Pinot. I judge all the others by it. And I thought, oh, well, that's lovely.
Yeah, they should.
I mean, it's our house wine, so we're just lucky enough to be used to it. But.
Yeah. What it's, I wish I could take, you know, the fact that I did something to it to make it the way it is. But really, what it is that I didn't do anything to it.
You just shepherded the grapes.
And that's the only way to make really good wine is to grow good grapes in a good area, get them actually correctly ripe, and then let it make itself. Mm-hmm. And
it's the only way to cook.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's the same.
It's how
thing.
You cook.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you keep on doing this with equally good grapes. We don't have that much time left because we've got a book review coming up. We have our new book critic. She's not really new anymore, but this year. What are some of the upcoming topics?
Upcoming topics. Excuse me. Next week I'm going to do potatoes, actually, as a focus topic, and I'm going to be using David Little's of Little Organic Farms' dry farm potatoes. And we're going to do gratin. We'll do a tasting of sort of herb-roasted potatoes, and we'll do a comparative thing. We'll approach potato salads from a lot of different angles. So I'd love to go in and really analyze what this is about. And then in August, I'm going to take the sort of French fermiture annuelle, you know, and actually work more on my website. And then we'll have back to school in September when I'll be doing what I call Tomato Madness Month. And
is that when you told me when you came in tonight that you
wanted
to
talk
about
BLT? Exactly, because I really laughed when I read your recent column because it spoke to my heart. It's that whole business. I apparently believe this because I hear myself saying this all the time in class. we want to do this because it's that layering of flavors and textures, and that's what it's all about.
Yes.
So you get, it dances all around the palate, and you get the sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and I like to add spicy.
And it has to unfold.
It has to unfold. And
I tried to teach a staff I was working with in a restaurant, and I mean, they threw knives at me because I made them layer the sandwich in the right way. You can't put the roasted peppers on top of the cheese after it melts. They have to go under it. Yeah. Feels, you know, and they're like, oh, you're such a fan. And then went through a cleaver at me and it stuck in the wall.
So,
it's all about the alchemy.
It is. It's a big part of, I think, why a lot of Asian food is so popular, because it gets that dance around your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter how great, let's say, an apple is, for me, about halfway through, I get a little bogged down, unless I'm ravenously hungry and really been depriving myself. So it's like we want to refresh our palate and also our texture sense, as well as the color. So the color draws us in, and then those other things keep us there.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think a BLT is a fine, fine thing.
Thank you. I do too. And one day soon, possibly before next Sunday, worldsbiggestblt.com will be live. And it's a very fun site. And there are two recipes on that site.
Oh, fabulous.
One is for a BLT made out of a whole loaf of bread. And one is for making your own bacon at home.
Oh, nice.
Which is really fun to do.
Nice.
It's really, really, really fun to do. We're out of time. So how do people get to the cooking school?
The cooking school, is in Petaluma. And the best way, I'll send directions if they either
get how do they find you?
How do they find me? They can call me at 707-778-7143.
That's 707-778-7143.
Or they can email me at kbaumhefner, kbaumhefner at hotmail.com.
Okay, that's kbaumhefner at hotmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
And Don, how do people find you and your wines? Not that I want them to.
Phone number would be the same.
That's 707-778-7143. Do you ship to states that allow
it? All over the country.
Okay.
And we actually have distributor in New York and Pennsylvania also. But and then for email, it's the same. It's donbaumhefner at hotmail.com.
And if someone sends a cooking school question or a wine question to the wrong one of us, we can work that out.
We'll answer. Yeah. And, you know, you can always get any of this information about Mouthful Guests at catsmilk@sonic.net. The show is also posted as a podcast on iTunes. Should always be there by Wednesday following the show. On that note, it's time for another book review from Laura Hager. So meet me back here next week. We have Jeff Kruth, the only master sommelier in Sonoma County. He works at the farmhouse, and it's a return visit here on Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. Eat something really good this week. Share it with someone you love.
I'm writing books. here's a foodie's dream. Jay Rayner, author of the new book, The Man Who Ate the World, traveled the globe eating in the world's best and most expensive restaurants in search of the perfect dinner. He hit all the expected places, Paris, New York, Tokyo, London, and some unexpected ones as well. Rayner is a food critic for the London Observer. He is one of a new generation of British food writers that the New York Times described as sometimes hilarious, astonishingly brutal restaurant critics who in the last few years have turned English food writing into a blood sport. Rayner begins his journey in Las Vegas, then moves on to Moscow and Dubai. His reasoning is this: food talent follows money, and where organized crime or oil sheiks are king, there's sure to be plenty of that. The meals in the restaurants he finds there, however, are for the most part disappointing. Even though their kitchens are run by world-famous chefs like Joel Robuchon and Gordon Ramsay. At Pushkin in Moscow, he writes, quote, "The dishes were to subtlety what Paris Hilton is to chastity," or in Dubai, "Al-Mahara is to good taste what Adolf Hitler was to world peace." Rayner's adventures in Moscow were downright surreal. The most intriguing restaurant he visits is the Sword and Shield, named after the emblem of the KGB. It's located right down the street from the old KGB headquarters at Lubyanka Prison and is owned in part by Vladimir Putin's wife, Putin himself being an old KGB hand. The problem, of course, with restaurants in Las Vegas, Moscow, and Dubai is that the phrase seasonal and local ingredients simply doesn't apply. Dubai and Las Vegas are deserts, and Russia is too cold and its agriculture still too Soviet to produce the type of ingredients that Californians and Parisians take for granted. In New York, he goes for a restaurant crawl with food blogger Steve Plotnicki of Opinionated About Food. They begin with eggs and caviar at Jean Georges, move on to Thomas Keller's oysters and pearls at Per Se. Still sprightly, they leap to Bouli in Tribeca for cod in dashi and seared foie gras, and then to 11 Madison Park for crispy duck and suckling pig. Barely upright at this point, they stumble into WD-50, where the food is not so much tasty as adventuresome, and order the entire dessert menu. Rayner takes Paris in a similar spirit, eating in a different Michelin 3-star restaurant every night for a week. In the end, he discovers that it really is possible to have too much of a good thing. He never finds his grail, the perfect meal, but he comes close at Pascal Bourbeau's L'Astrance in Paris and Tokyo's Yakimura and Okai Sushi. It's a grand ride, though, and while I found Rayner's macho banter annoying at first, by the end of the book I had to admit that it would be hard to find a more amusing dinner companion for an armchair tour of the best restaurants in the world. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful. Na, 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 na.
Support for Mouthful on KRCB comes from KRCB Radio members and from the Sebastopol Farmers Market, now open in the downtown Sebastopol Plaza every Sunday from 10 to 1:30 with organic, sustainable, locally produced fruits, vegetables, meats, and cheeses, plus breakfast, lunch, and local musicians. Support also comes from Peter Lowell's Cafe in Sebastopol, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner in the rustic Italian tradition, featuring seasonally sourced organic produce. Serving brunch Saturday and Sunday, Peter Lowell's Cafe online at peterlowells.com. Support also comes from NetBooks, complete business management software for companies up to 50 people, including wineries and food producers. Information available at netbooks.com or by phone at 86-NETBOOKS. Now listen to what the preacher says.